Thank you very much, Mr. Craig. Can you hear all right? I guess we... as writers and scholars, as interpreters of currents of ideas and patterns of life, I think we need to look beyond the contemporary scene in our country and attempt to gauge the character of our world in the final years of this century. We can be very sure that the world of the late 1990s will be very different from the world of 1983. Change has been with us in every decade of the 20th century, but it is likely to be vastly accelerated. We live in a swirling cloud of economic change. Technological development is moving at a pace we never imagined even a few years ago. Old ideological commitments are dissolving or shifting. New dislocations are resulting from the unprecedented changes. All this adds up to a bewildering world and great difficulty in estimating what will happen between now and the end of this century. We discern some of the problems and opportunities of the years ahead, but certainly not all. As Carol Huye, the Czech-born astronomer and philosopher, said, we live in an age prone to unexpected problems. For all our interest in futurology, I think we have an inadequate awareness of how much change will take place in this country and abroad, and how the change will affect our values and mode of life. Indeed, we often seem unaware of the extent of change that has taken place in the last few years. Economic and technological change has come upon us like a storm. 20 years ago, the United States was the greatest industrial power in the world. In the past 2 decades, we've lost much of our preeminence. 20 years ago, the United States imported $7 billion worth of manufactured goods. Last year, we imported $143 billion in manufactured goods, an increase of almost 2,000%. The effect of this is to be found in the blighted industrial centers of the United States, in the rundown of our basic industries, and in the resulting unemployment. There's been a profound degradation of America's industrial power. And writing under the caption, U.S. Supremacy Passes into History, a contributor to the New York Times gleefully declared in recent weeks that the United States will not be able to retain its rule as unchallenged world leader in the technological and economic sphere. The impact of our economic decline in the past 10 years since the first oil shock is reflected in the understandable concern of able young professional people that they are living in a period of downward mobility. Indeed, Americans have lowered their material expectations. It is infinitely harder for young Americans to own a car and a home, amenities that came so easily in the 1940s and 50s, and which the 60s generation came to regard almost as their birthright. As Fran Schumer wrote in New York Magazine last August, upward mobility is no longer a fact of American life. Young Americans can no longer assume that they will do better than their parents. There is less faith in America's economic prospects in the world, less hope among the young middle class that the future will close the gap between them and their parents. Young Americans no longer have that feeling of unlimited possibility. Hard work, saving, the Protestant work ethic may not pay off in an era in which there is an oversupply of people with advanced degrees. I live in a small college town, and I see evidence of this all around me. Some Americans are doing brilliantly, of course, but the obstacles for the young are much greater than in my generation. There are many reasons for all this, including overproduction of some types of skills, displacement of people with skills that are no longer necessary, unionism that is unconcerned with productivity, transfer of America's wealth to arrogant, dependent nations, imprudent lending by American banking institutions, often under heavy pressure from the government, waste in public spending, deteriorated public education and yielding to blackmail by the OPEC oil producers. Altogether, these causes have contributed to the making of a bad time in American life, a period of decline. For the moment, it seems that the hemorrhage of dollars to the OPEC oil producers will be slowed, which should be an immense boon to us. Other problems lie ahead, however, other changes which, while they may actually lead to a renewal of opportunity, will pose severe problems in the interim. Again, I'd like to return to economic and technological change. The shift from the buggy to the automobile to the jet took decades. In the 1980s and 90s, colossal, unprecedented change will be compressed into a few years. This is the meaning of the structural unemployment of today, of the unemployed steelworker who is waiting to return to his old job, but whose old job is gone forever. In the past, as Governor Pierre DuPont of Delaware recently observed, the schools provided a youth with a skill needed for a lifetime of work. Today, one skill is not enough for one generation. New skills are required by millions of Americans as we convert from smokestack industries to computer industries. In the process, millions of people are being displaced. Many Americans may be on welfare for years. Many communities may experience serious depopulation. These shattering changes will have an impact on the beliefs and values of the affected people. Those who are caught in the crush of change may be very angry and bitter. Their hardship will be severe. They may lose faith in our system. The displacement of people by robots has been aptly described, I think, as social dynamite. And we may ask ourselves, how many of these displaced people will subscribe to conservative values? I worry about the dislocations that have taken place that are coming between now and the year 2000. Much of the dislocation is inevitable, as early phases of the Industrial Revolution were inevitable and brought hardship as well as opportunity. People in our time are less passive, however. They know more about the national and world scene. They may respond to change in very undesirable ways. On the other hand, some measure of hardship may be good for us as a people. Freer Stark, the British writer, has said with much truth that, quote, perhaps it is ease we must never have. Always we have to be on tiptoe to grow a little towards what we may be. And as soon as we stand comfortably on what feels safe ground, the very ground opens and swallows us. Whatever the moral impact of changed economic and technological conditions, we can be reasonably sure that we won't have any quiet, stable periods in the remaining years of this century. Change is occurring too quickly, more change than man has ever had to adjust to in one lifetime, and it will be rough on our psyches. I'm reminded of Leon Trotsky's statement that anyone who wanted a quiet life should not have been born into the 20th century. Now, we aren't the only country experiencing, or system experiencing, change. The seemingly monolithic Soviet system cannot avoid profound change. For all its armed might, the Soviet Union has a weak, archaic economy. It is poorly positioned to respond to the computer revolution. It is committed to central state planning, which is grossly inadequate and which fetters the productive process. The introduction of the new technology runs counter to ministerial empires, to the power of apparatchiks, to centralization. And I think it's reasonable to conclude that enormous technological change cannot be accomplished within the straitjacket of the Communist Party-controlled system. The vastly more backward system in place in communist China also cannot be improved without scrapping the political and economic edifice created since 1949. In both countries, the problems will be horrendous. Around the world, one of the major changes of the next 20 years will be population movements. Indeed, such movements always have been determinants of history. The Roman Empire broke down because of the population movements on its frontiers, movements which could not be controlled or contained. Western civilization almost disappeared under the waves of Islamic power in the 8th century. The United States, as presently constituted, is the result of vast population movements from Europe to the New World. We are still absorbing the population transfers of 80 years ago and the inner migration of black Americans in the post-World War II period. Much attention has been devoted to the flood of illegal immigrants from Mexico and the Caribbean, and deservedly so, for the character of the United States will be changed by the influx of people from areas that have very different political and cultural traditions, where the spirit of individual liberty is little known. The increased Latinization of America is one of those unexpected problems that Dr. Huye referred to. What will it mean? We need to ponder that question. Despite all the ethnic threads of contemporary America, our constitutional system, our concept of nationhood and proper citizen behavior is derived from our colonial experience in the 18th century, from British tradition with its accent on liberty and personal responsibility. Will that tradition continue to be operative in the U.S. in the 21st century? America is something of a new amalgam in every generation. We accept that, but we want to be very sure that the process of Americanization is very thorough, and that under the pressures of waves of immigrants from the Southern Hemisphere, we don't shift away from Western civilization, from the body of ideas we received from Europe. Engaging our future, we should realize that our country is an island in a hostile world. It won't be easy for us to retain our commitment to Western traditions, which made possible the climate of liberty in the United States. As we ponder our national future, we ought to bear in mind that for half a millennium, the Western model of life prevailed. All the continents were exposed to the processes of Westernization, to our ideas of government, civil order, human behavior, religion, and justice. The process of Westernization was arrested by the two world wars. Since the end of World War II, other cultures have been resurgent. Much of the world has turned against the West. The United States, as the leading Western power in society, is the target of endless abuse. Witness the recent meeting of the so-called non-allied nations in Delhi. In our country, we've been urged to look beyond the West, to dilute our dedication to Western ideas. There's a movement in our country, sometimes conscious, sometimes unconscious, to reject Western models and to identify with the Third World and its revolutionary movements and notions. For example, at UNESCO, we are urged to abandon the Western concept of independent news reporting and to adopt the Third World notion of reporting as an exercise in propaganda and uplift of a regime or revolutionary party. Influential Western institutions, notably the churches, have been in the vanguard of embracing anti-Western ideas. Thomas Molnar touched on this in a brilliant essay in National Review last August. Discussing the future of the Catholic Church, he cited an accommodation between Rome and an emerging post-Western civilization. He added that there is a worldwide policy of civilizational adjustment. Yesterday's popular terms, he noted, such as democracy, liberalism, parliamentarianism, are fading out. We see the post-Western, post-democratic outlook embodied in such developments as the so-called liberation theology, which embraces Marxist revolutionary movements. The various branches of Christianity in the West are doing their best to divorce themselves from a strictly Western orientation, and this usually involves hostility to the United States and its capitalist economic system. The churches, certainly my own denomination, the Episcopal Church, increasingly favors a detachment from Western styles of thinking and political order, and the new churchmen display a socialist fervor. All this is part of the context of American life, the climate of ideas and influences which surrounds us, what we do in the economic and technological spheres. It is part of the environment of change, the pressure inside the crucible of our nation's life. The task facing American conservatives in the complex and pressure-filled period ahead is much greater than we envisioned 20 or 30 years ago. Then we had a much more simple and secure society. We had limited targets, such as the New Frontier, the Great Society. We were aware of the heritage of liberalism and leftism in this country, the infatuation of many intellectuals with with collectivist solutions. And we were prepared to deal with this. Our economy was very strong, however. We were in a period of growth when we could point to the enormous success of our economic system in providing a better life for millions of our citizens. We had the confidence of a generation that had won a great war against totalitarianism. Much of the world was grateful for our assistance, or not, certainly not openly hostile. Soviet military power was a fraction of what it is today. Most importantly, we had only to deal with the old left. The new left had not appeared. The vast literature hostile to the traditions and economic system of the United States, which we know today, had not been produced. We had not lost a war in Southeast Asia. The churches were yet to tell us that we should shoulder an immense burden of guilt, and that as a nation we should divest ourselves of our power and admit the moral superiority of the Third World. Well, the world is very different now. The conservatives of the 1980s and 90s will have to reckon with a much more complex situation. Economic difficulty at home, armed and ideological challenges abroad, and a massive rejection of Western values and traditions by many of our most important institutions. The future then offers, I think, a forbidding prospect. We have to translate conservative values and principles in the context of this emerging world. We have to inspire love of country, promote faith in our economic order, help maintain traditions, strengthen a sense of community, protect the family, and all in all, safeguard the core of what conservatism means, of what Western civilization means, in a world of immense change and heavy pressures. Conservatives have to carry out these tasks at every level, in the bosom of their families, in their communities, churches, educational institutions. A special burden falls on conservatives who deal with ideas, who are writers and scholars, researchers and philosophers. The arguments we advance to defend our country and civilization from the 1940s through the 1970s may not be adequate or suitable for the task ahead. Conservatives are supposed to uphold the permanent things, as our friend Russell Kirk has said so many times, and some of which I've just mentioned. But there's nothing fixed about the economic, political, and social order in which we live. It is essential that we examine and re-examine the conditions of life and seek appropriate ways to apply basic principles to shifting practices. Our adversaries, so to speak, the liberals, aren't what one would term innovative. If 1933 returns, they are ready. Their sole answer to the problems of a changing economic and social order is more regimentation, more control. It's interesting that in the economic sphere, they assign a high priority to plant closure penalty legislation, which would freeze the nation's industries in place and forbid the mobility which has been characteristic of the American response to opportunity. For our part, however, we must be careful not to repeat ourselves or to propose public policies that are applicable chiefly to the experience of the past 25 years. We are at the end of one era of American conservatism, an era which began in the 1940s and culminated in political terms in the election of President Reagan. I can't tell you exactly how the years ahead will be different, or exactly how conservatism should be reshaped for changed conditions, but I'm convinced that we will need new approaches. Danger always exists that ideas harden into dogma, fixed opinions that ignore realities. Rigidity of mind is as much a threat to conservatism as liberalism. Conservatives aren't immune to a hardening of opinion that prevents them from seeing the world as it is, or that causes them to ignore important evidence. A measure of humility doesn't ill become a conservative. Having attended many gatherings of conservatives over a long period of years, I've been struck by the fact that conservatives can be intellectually arrogant as liberals. Certainly, we must fight against that tendency. In this connection, we should keep in mind that the American people will be what they want to be. Unlike the liberals or the left, we as conservatives don't seek to regiment the American people. We simply want to be a beneficial influence and remind the American people of their traditional values. And we endeavor to provide what we deem to be helpful ideas and policies which will ensure the well-being of our citizens. We always should be mindful of the fact that the American people are a remarkable people with an extraordinary mix of skills and proven capacity to endure hardship and struggle, as our record in past wars attests. We have a people with a deep love of country, as was so plainly indicated in the American reaction to the Iranian hostage situation. We have reason to be concerned, of course, because moral disorder has grown in the past two decades. Education has been deficient. Crime has flourished. And our national will sometimes has seemed severely impaired. We hope to be an influence in eliminating or correcting such conditions. We recognize that there are powerful nihilistic forces at work in American life. Rejection of our heritage among those who deem themselves intellectuals. Countering those forces, those rejectionists, may be the central task for those of us who belong to this society and to others who share our outlook in the country. Conservatism, therefore, has to be, first of all, a philosophical position. It has to be concerned, first of all, with the good of society as a whole, not simply the individual. It has to be for liberty, but not narrowly libertarian in the sense that we do not feel any responsibility for our neighbor. It has to be concerned with personal behavior and standards that derive from our cultural and religious history. It has to stress responsibility as much as freedom. It has to recognize the importance of economics, but not base itself on the notion that man lives by economics alone. If we adhere to these ideas, I believe our nation will move into the 21st century in good shape. I hope our conservative ideas and beliefs will have conservative consequences. I don't believe we can assume that they necessarily will do so, for man is fallible and shot through with imperfections. We can't expect the future to guarantee success to us in our labors. But at least we know how we must labor, how we must use our material and intellectual resources to preserve and advance the values of our country and civilization. If we don't work vigorously, if we aren't discerning, determined, and humble in the face of reality, our country and our civilization most assuredly will collapse. For the ideas and values advanced by the collectivists are incompatible. Freedom. Pleasure talking with you this morning.